Welcome to Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and today we have a very special show for you. We will be talking to Stan Goff. And before we get into that, we're going to do some news headlines from the Indie Media Network. Starting off, from indiemedia.org, by way of Ottawa and Maritimes IMC, Canadians march against Bush. George W. Bush's trip to Ottawa and Halifax in Canada was met with mass protests and creative resistance this week. Protesters from Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, and all surrounding areas converged on Ottawa on November 30th in the thousands. The rally began at noon in front of Ottawa City Hall. Speakers representing Ottawa City Council, unions, the Mohawk Nation, and many other groups set the tone for the massive march. Bush is not welcome in Ottawa. By the time the march reached its final destination, the crowd swelled from about 8,000 to about 15,000, blanketing the large front lawn of the Parliament with anti-Bush banners, placards, and slogans. In Halifax, the march began at about 10:30 or so. The sound of drumming and chanting, the march made its way towards Pier 21 along the waterfront, where Bush was delivering his warmongering message of the need for more Canadian participation in the war on terror, as well as ballistic missile offense system. Check out Ottawa and Maritimes INC at through indiemedia.org. Also, December 3rd, this is from indiemedia.org, December 3rd marks the 20th anniversary of the world's worst peacetime massacre, the 1984 Union Carbide gas disaster in Bhopal, India, a runaway reaction inside a subsidiary's poorly designed and under-maintained pesticides plant released a 27-ton cocktail of lethal toxic gases into the heart of a teeming old city. Within a few days, more than 500,000 people remained for life. At least 8,000 were killed in agonizing seizures and trampled to death in the rush from the factory. Over the past 20 years, Carbide has taken elaborate steps to protect its financial interests in ways that have directly prolonged and deepened the physical, social, environmental, and economic miseries of those left alive in Bhopal. Survivors of the disaster suffer from a range of multi-systemic problems, including lung injuries, immune disorders, gynecological and mental illnesses, and chromosomal damage. Treatment protocols do not exist to combat the many manifestations of gas exposure. Carbide has steadfastly refused to release toxicological studies on the principal toxin, methyl isocyanate, or vital information on the composition of the gas cloud that seeped over Bhopal. To this day, Union Carbide has refused to clean up the decaying factory and site, where as a result of the routine dumping, carcinogenic chemicals and heavy metals seep into the water supplies of an estimated 20,000 people in the surrounding communities. Follow this story. You can go to indiemedia.org and read up more on what's happening. And lastly, this is from indiemedia.us by way of Santa Cruz. November 30th, 1999 represented a triumphal moment for worldwide civil resistance against a global economic system that gives private corporations more power than governments. And this is 5 years after the Battle of Seattle. In the morning hours of N30, 1999, tens of thousands of activists from across the globe converged in the streets of downtown Seattle to shut down meetings of the World Trade Organization, the undemocratic international governing forum of neoliberal globalization. The conflict became infamous around the world, partially because of the violent police response to the largely peaceful demonstrations. In years since, N30 has been remembered in the streets of Seattle and around the globe with marches, rallies, and celebrations of resistance. Dialogues about effectiveness of the movement have multiplied in number, both within and beyond activist circles. The date is also remembered as the birth of the Independent Media Center. Okay, I'd like to move on and begin my introduction of Stan Goff. Stan Goff was a soldier in Army Special Operations, which included Delta Force, Rangers, and Special Forces, and took him from invasions of Vietnam, Grenada, and Haiti to the training grounds of Colombian and Peruvian armed forces. He taught military science at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, conducted classified missions in El Salvador and Guatemala, and was deployed with the ill-fated Task Force Ranger to Mogadishu. Goff left the military in the mid-90s, according to a description on the back of his recent book, Full Spectrum Disorder. Goff interprets his own experience through years of post-military searching since he left the military and draws some starkly brutal conclusions about the risks we all face in the dangerous last days of an unstable empire. I came across Stan's articles on the counterpunch.org website and was immediately struck by some very coherent arguments, carefully crafted writing, and solid analysis about American empire. Goff is author of Hideous Dream, a soldier's memoir of the U.S. invasion of Haiti, and Full Spectrum Disorder. He's a member of Bring Them Home Now Coordinating Committee. His periodic essays on the military can be found at freedomroad.org. Stan, welcome to Indie Media On Air.
Hi.
So I'd like to start off the discussion by briefly talking about this transformation you went through from Army Special Operations soldier to someone that is not only critical of U.S. imperialism, as you describe the system, but one that has clearly spent a long time developing a very sharp analysis of U.S. foreign policy. Can you give us a brief history of this transformation and perhaps a few examples of experiences that led you to these stark, brutal conclusions?
This is a real frequent question because people always think that it's sort of paradoxical that a former soldier, especially a career soldier and someone who worked in the special ops field, be embracing the politics of resistance or the politics of the left. But it's really not that big a leap. If you look at the special forces motto, oddly enough, it's Deo Presso Liber, to liberate the oppressed. And many people go into military service with the expectation that they're, you know, with the belief that they're serving some higher calling, you know, that we really are, you know, the beacon of morality in the world and so forth. You know, I came in the military when I was 18 years old, so.
Right.
You know, I was young and I sort of bought the whole thing. Back then, of course, it wasn't the war on terrorism. It was the domino theory. And, you know, we had to go stop the communists in Vietnam before they marched on Hot Springs, Arkansas. And, you know, we were naive and we believed that most of American society is still pretty naive. But, you know, for what I witnessed in the military, I really could have been a lot faster learner, I think. I did go to 8 conflict areas and a number of other places that are sort of dicey around the world and had an opportunity to see a lot. But seeing is not the same thing as understanding it. And that's what really took the time. I understood that something was wrong, but I didn't have the interpretive tools to figure out why it was wrong at that point in time. And by the time I really started looking at, you know, systemic critiques, I was already enlisted past my retirement date, and that really started to come together just prior to the invasion of Haiti. Probably what began a process of questioning was the work that I'd done in Central America, in particular Guatemala and El Salvador. And not because I saw anything that was particularly horrendous. I saw plenty that was ugly in places like Vietnam. But what I did have an opportunity to do in Central America was to work directly under the control of the U.S. Embassy. And so I got sort of an atypical soldier's peek at the inside of a U.S. embassy and saw how the direct representative of the United States government's executive branch in foreign countries made decisions. And, you know, it's a pretty interesting thing to watch, to see how, you know, you have a consular team or a consular representative as part of the country team. You have a security representative as part of the country team. You have a military group representative as part of the country team. You have, you know, your various attaches. And, the people who really set the agenda are, aside from the ambassador himself or herself, were the representative from the economic section. Economic section of the U.S. Embassy is directed by someone whose function is to be a direct liaison between the United States government and the host nations. National Chamber of Commerce. This was very interesting to me because up until that point, a Chamber of Commerce was something I didn't really understand. I thought it was a bunch of Rotarians that sat around and ate chicken salad and told stories to one another. You know, I didn't realize what a key and powerful organization it was, especially at a national level. And that's when I think I started to put things together and say, oh, there's an economic piece to this that I haven't looked at, because I'd really tried to look at the whole situation, all the things that I observed before through moral lenses, and it didn't really, it served to continue to force me to question, but it didn't serve to clarify the situation for me. And it was a process of thinking about that, and then toward the end of my career, actually beginning to sort of look for some different analyses, and that's when I started, you know, familiarizing myself with some of the forbidden text, you know, the Marx and Fanon and other people who, you know, had been demonized in my cosmology, and I found out that they had some pretty interesting things to say.
So these experiences led you to a systemic analysis.
Absolutely. I mean, the military gave me probably the finest radical education in the world. I was sent all over the world, in many cases, especially in the special operations field, where you're doing a fair amount of cultural immersion, living very close to the host nation population, and observing things like real poverty, real third world poverty. And you know, one of the things that's interesting about it is you can see a slum in Lima. You can see a slum in Bogota. You can see a slum in, you know, Caracas. You can see a slum in East Africa. You can see, and you can see a slum in Haiti. And they're very similar. Even those, these are countries and national entities that have very diverse histories under the existing global system. They've become rationalized. They've become standardized to some extent, and this poverty has been standardized. And poverty looks and smells about the same anywhere you go. That was pretty interesting to me, and that's what sort of led me to think that maybe there was something in common, and eventually led me to identify that something in common is a world system that's dominated by U.S. imperial interests.
Well, that brings me to my question, and the focus I'd like to look at is you wrote an article called "Debating a Neocon," and there's no there debating a neocon. And the article raises quite a number of very important analytical points, and I want to touch on a few of those. And I don't think they're discussed enough, and I was really surprised to see it and to see it out there in a very, very clear manner. You debated a guy by the name of Patrick Claussen, and you say, "It's truly remarkable how easily knocked out these neocons are once you step outside the tight little ring of the Republicrats. There may be three combinations, and they are slow as a cow. Everything inside has been in ritual combat, and they do very badly when someone actually intends to hit them." And this guy wasn't just a lightweight. He had a long list of sort of achievements with Near East Policy, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, well, I was invited down there by one of the professors that was at Winthrop University in South Carolina. And, you know, I thought, well, maybe I better Google search this guy and see who it is that I'm debating. And when I did, you know, all this stuff came up. You know, he speaks like six languages and has, you know, a whole alphabet behind his name and all this. And, in a way, you know, I was sort of intimidated because I thought, you know, this guy's going to hit me with all kinds of, you know, supportive data and all sorts of anecdotal stuff that I don't know about. And, you know, I was really afraid he was going to get the best of me. And what was surprising was when we got there, I was just hearing a rehash of the same crap that you hear from these talking heads on TV. It was just incredibly simple-minded, you know, grossly transparent stuff. I mean, the most common argument he had for continuing the occupation in Iraq was that, well, we're under the pottery barn rule. The pottery barn rule being that if you break it, you own it. This is ridiculous. They're paying this guy big bucks. He's working in one of these, you know, high-powered, right-wing funded think tanks that was very, very close to this administration. You know, one of this network of think tanks that the neocons have, and that the best thing that they can come up with is, well, you know, we were wrong about everything before the war, but now that we're there, we can't leave. That was the best they could come up with, and I was really sort of stunned, that they wouldn't attempt to do any better than that. And then it occurred to me, that's the best they've got. This thing has become so transparently awful now that they have no rationales to deploy for it anymore. And not only were their justifications for this war false and transparent in the beginning, now they're faced with a situation where, initially they were losing the war politically. I mean, almost from the outset they were losing this war politically. Now it appears that they're actually in a position where they could lose this war tactically as well. So they're on their heels. I mean, that was the most interesting thing about this, was to see how badly damaged they were. And I mean, the lesson that I took away from that is, don't pay much attention to what went on in the elections, because the elections are this sort of, you know, this crafted exercise. You got two members of the same fraternity up there talking about who can do the best job of winning an unwinnable war. Wow, I mean, an American population that's working 20% more than they did 10 years ago, don't have access to any information because the media has been so thoroughly co-opted, and their window on the world is the 30 minutes that they can make in the evening, if they're so inclined, to turn on headline news and watch a news model doing a spin job for the Department of Defense. That's why the elections turned out the way
right.
they did. You know, it wasn't because the American people are stupid. They're ignorant, and there's a difference.
Right.
And they're ignorant because that ignorance is intentional. the people who run things, the people who produce knowledge for this society, are not producing real knowledge.
Right. You know, it brings me to my next question is, you say in the debate, you say Iraq is symptomatic of a much deeper global crisis, and that it foreshadows a period in which that crisis, a crisis of global capitalism, will manifest itself not only in war, but in rapidly widening social destabilization, the further militarization of the world system, and simultaneous economic and environmental collapse. And within that context, I want to ask you, what are the current tactical military situation in Iraq, and given your expertise, what do you make of it?
I would recommend to people who don't follow this, and this is sort of a paid political announcement, go to our website, bringthemhomenow.org. It's a website. We have a campaign, Military Families Speak Out and Veterans for Peace, both of which I'm a member, have a coalition campaign called Bring Them Home Now. And it's designed to appeal to military families, veterans, and active duty service members. So bringthemhomenow.org is the website. On that website, we do daily news updates. And what we do is we scour the international news for real information about what's going on. And we have archived all the way back from the beginning of July last year, every single day, the key stories coming out of Iraq. And the reason I suggest people go, and we have a lot of imagery that we've posted under fair use as well, the reason I suggest people go back to that is because this is a very accessible, user-friendly archive that people can use to sort of track the quote progress, unquote, of this war. And if you go back and look at those stories dating back to just a year and a half ago, what you'll find is that there's sort of this monotonous repetition of lies that have a half-life of about 3 days, of what gets reported on CNN or what gets reported from the Department of Defense. They're always, you know, trying to put a positive spin on things, and everything that they say tends to fall apart in a half a week to a week. And this becomes real apparent when you start sort of following these news stories all the way through the chronology of the war, beginning when we put the campaign together, which was about 3 months after the ground offensive in March 2003. So, you know, the first thing to say is that they're losing, and this has become very apparent. That's why, you know, they said, well, we're not going to send more troops. Story out today is that we won't be pulling troops. They were saying we won't pull troops out until 2005. Then they said 2006. Today they're saying 2008. That was something that got leaked to the Scottish press. So they already know that it's impossible for them to get out before 2008 and still achieve any of the most rudimentary goals, the real goals of this war. They attack a place like Fallujah, and they manage to turn more people into guerrillas than those that they kill. You know, they report that they've killed umpteen hundred insurgents, but what's strange is that they report that they've killed no civilians. So they go into, you know, highly, you know, very dense urban areas and manage to surgically eliminate all the insurgents, and nobody. I mean, you know, this is Vietnam stuff all over again.
Right.
As they do, when they attack Fallujah, they've had to pull so many American troops out of Baghdad that they have to pull the British troops up from Basra to cover southern Baghdad again. The Green Zone's now being hit with great regularity and more accuracy. We're spending, I think it's like $20,000 a day just to keep that puppet Alawi alive, which is a complete waste, since the guy's an oxygen thief and a thug from the get. As they attack Fallujah, Mosul breaks out. Ramadi is completely controlled by the guerrillas right now. And Fallujah, that they've declared victory in every day for the past 3 weeks, there's still active fighting going on there. So now we're upping the numbers to 150,000 that are reported. That doesn't count the 20,000 mercenaries that are on the ground. The second biggest combat force in Iraq is not the 11,000 British soldiers. It's these mercenaries working for SAIC and Dyne Corp and all these other outfits, Blackwell and, you know. So they've got a situation where tactically it's being referred to now as squeezing jello. They're in a situation where there's a form of resistance taking place in Iraq right now for which there is no military doctrine to counter it, given the political situation that the U.S. finds itself in there right now. They're losing the war. They've been losing the war, and they're going to continue to lose the war because success in war is not predicated on tactical outcomes. It's predicated on political outcomes. That's what's important for people to understand. That's how they lost Vietnam. And, you know, I hear, this is not Vietnam. This is Iraq. It's all different. We don't have the Soviet Union, China. We don't have this well-developed, communist cadre. We don't have jungles and yada yada. Okay, all that's true. But two key things about Iraq are important to understand. One is that the United States government has now gotten itself into a situation that politically it can't leave and that militarily it can't win. That's Vietnam. That's Vietnam.
Stan,
that's where we are right now.
You unequivocally support the right of Iraqis to oppose or fight U.S. occupation, and yet you also say you don't want to see any U.S. soldiers killed. How does one reconcile this contradiction, or apparent contradiction?
It's that, you know, U.S. soldiers are part of a system just like everyone. In fact, I was noting the story about Union Carbide that we talked, that y'all were reporting just a little while ago. You know, a lot of people have forgotten about that. 8,000 dead and hundreds of thousands maimed, most for life. People are in this system. They can't get up. There's people in the United States right now, union members that we might support in certain of their struggles, who work for Union Carbide, just the same as people work for the military. The people that work for Union Carbide are as essential to the continuation of this system as the people that work for the military. Different components of the same system. And they don't make choices about this stuff. I mean, they make choices, but the choices that are severely circumscribed by their own circumstances. My own son went in the military because he had an infant son, a job at McDonald's with no benefits, and no options that were out there for him. And that's where a lot of these kids go in the military.
Right.
So, now, that they went in the military doesn't mean that they sit around and decide what national policy is, you know. And any of us that are paying our income taxes right now are underwriting this war. The people responsible for the situation are not the people who are defending their homes and their autonomy and their self-determination in Iraq, and they're not these kids that are being sent over there to do Uncle Sam's wet work. The criminals are in Washington, D.C., and that's, you know, that's not a reconciliation of a contradiction. It's pointing out that it's a false contradiction. This is not a war against the American people or even the American military and the insurgents, except at the most superficial level. It's a very dangerous and deadly level. But it's a superficial level because they're not making the decision to put those people out there.
Right.
Those are people in Washington, D.C. They wear $5,000 suits and they eat caviar.
You say in the during the debate with the neocon, Patrick Claassen, you say, "I don't believe the very people who call this a war on terrorism believe it for 1 minute. Or moreover, I believe they know perfectly well that the term war on terrorism is oxymoronic inasmuch as one cannot prosecute a war against a tactic."
Yeah, well, this is just sort of common sense, but you have to think about it for a minute to understand why it's common sense. Terrorism is a method.
I think we need a little common sense in these times, especially in the media system in the U.S.
Well, the problem is that the stuff that is common sense is not sensible. When you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Most people would say, you know, we've got to fight terrorism. That's common sense, but you've got to take it a step further. What does that mean? This is a tactic. We have a military right now that costs more than any other military in the history of the universe. And it can deploy such awesome and lethal technological military force, conventional force, that there's categorically no other nation in the world, no other military, no other combination of militaries in the world that can successfully confront that kind of conventional military force in a toe-to-toe conventional form of combat. That means that the only option that's left for the rest of the world is either, one, bend to the will of this military when it's deployed against you, or, two, adopt asymmetrical tactics. And you know, terrorism is not a doctrine. Terrorism is the weapon that's available to the weak. When you don't have cruise missiles, then you have to come up with some other way of inflicting damage on your enemy. Either that or you capitulate to them. So it's the size and the scope and the lethality of the U.S. military that makes terrorism an inevitability. But it's an inevitable tactic that's going to be generated, and it's the system itself that's generating the resistance. You get it? We could do a couple of very simple things and essentially erase most of the terrorist threat to the United States right now. And there really is a threat. You know, we're extremely vulnerable. We've got 104 nuclear power plants all over the country right now. And I could sit down here, I won't do it on the radio, but I could sit down here and describe 10 different ways that you could go over there and destroy one of those things and cause a massive release of the cesium-137 that's in their spent fuel pools. I could describe that to you. It's very easy. It's not something that takes rocket science, and it's something someone could do with very minimal expense. All you got to have is the willingness to sacrifice a couple of lives in the process, which the 9/11 folks demonstrated could be done.
Right.
So we're vulnerable. We're vulnerable, but people forget that people don't do this because they hate freedom and democracy. They have some real grievances that can't be addressed in any other way. If the United States would do, two things. One is bring all their military troops from abroad back to the United States like everybody else does. Most of the countries don't send their militaries outside their own country to establish bases in other people's countries. It would be offensive for them to do so. Do that, number one, bring all the military troops home to the United States. And two is to drop our uncritical support of the apartheid state of Israel. Those two things all by themselves would do more to guarantee the security of the United States than any other thing we could do. It would also free up, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to repair our crumbling social infrastructure, you know. But we're not thinking about that. And the reason we're not thinking about that is because we're not given the information to think at all.
Well, I mean,
the people who are making the decisions have to continue to do what they do in order to stay in power.
I mean, you've answered your own questions in terms of why this won't happen in these debates. And you talk about imperialism, you talk about oil, and I want to shift to that for a second in the concept of resource control. You say in terms of imperialism, it's a real system and is currently directed by the American state. Mm-hmm. Iraq was probably the inevitable action of the state in response to an impending and inexorable erosion of the very basis of American global power. And while the war is morally repugnant, it's not a failure of morality, but an action of a system that can't help it. And then you talk about oil, and oil it's cheaper to buy oil than to steal it, but it's about hegemony. It's about control.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I would say I'd want to differentiate that term, because hegemony is control that's exercised through the consent of the governed. It's whenever, you know, we have hegemony in the United States because in 2000 we can have someone, you know, steal an election and everybody complains for a couple of days and goes home. Where, you know, I can go to a place like Haiti where someone steals an election, we'll be dealing with riots in the streets. See, they have not internalized that control like we have. You see what I'm saying? That's hegemony. The hegemony of the United States globally right now is really the hegemony over its partner competitors. The other big economies in the world are in a situation right now where their own ruling classes are subordinate to the U.S. state. And so they've internalized those controls, and they've internalized the ideology of the master state, you see. But in many cases, it's no longer a question of hegemony. It's just a question of outright control. And we're seeing right now in Latin America more and more local and indigenous mass movements are beginning to rise up and assert themselves against U.S. domination, be it direct U.S. domination or U.S. domination that's exercised through its controlling plurality and veto power inside the International Monetary Fund, a sort of debt leverage that gets used against all these indebted third world countries. But we've seen popular rebellions in Ecuador and Bolivia. In Peru, most recently, there was almost a rebellion in the form of an electoral watershed in Uruguay. We've seen, you know, this popular government, this popular democracy in Venezuela that's got the ruling class here very concerned. We've got a long-standing and successful insurgency in Bolivia, and we still have a socialist state on our border in Cuba, which makes them very mad. It has probably more credibility in that part of the world than we do right now. And there's Haiti's dear to my heart. Haiti is also involved in an anti-imperialist intifada of its own right now. So, you know, a lot of these places are no longer accepting. The governed are not consenting any longer, and so these conflicts are coming out into the open. What's unfortunate from the point of view of U.S. finance capital and the ruling class in this country is that they can't, they're so tangled up in Iraq right now that they don't have the capacity to confront all these problems as they emerge. And the real crisis of American hegemony in Iraq right now is not just that they're politically have lost the war, tactically they're beginning to lose the war, and that they've managed to piss off the entire region for about the next three generations. It's that one of the purposes of this war was to demonstrate American military invincibility to the rest of the world, this demonstration effect.
And you talk about that failing.
Well, and it's failing. That's right. What's happened now is everybody in the world is sort of alert and saying, well, maybe they're not so bad after all. And they would be right. And that's exactly why you see, you know, these movements in places like Latin America being energized, not just by the fact that they see that the great hegemon is not as powerful as everybody, you know, the great Oz is not as powerful as he seems, but also because they've about reached the limit of what they're willing to put up with.
So what do people do? What do you recommend in terms of movement building, in terms of fighting this war?
Oh, I think we have to go. I think we have to resurrect the anti-war movement after this god-awful election distraction we just went through, because that really stood down a huge portion of the anti-war movement. And I want to make a distinction. You know, there were several movements prior to March 20th, 2003. There was sort of an anti-Bush movement that had an anti-war component. But we had people all over the map. Some people, would oppose the invasion without a UN resolution. And then other people said, well, we oppose the invasion altogether. Because it doesn't look like Iraq is any threat to it. And then there was sort of a left pole of that movement that had a more conscious anti-imperialist character to it. And those movements, as the situation changed, with the ground offensive going north on March 20th in 2003, then we lost a segment of the so-called anti-war movement because they said, well, now they're gone, the situation's changed, and we got to support the troops. So we lost that segment. And then as we got closer and closer to elections and the Democratic Party, selected their guy, the DLC and Wall Street selected John Kerry to run against George Bush, we had all sorts of people that, in my opinion, deluded themselves that this was going to somehow be a solution, even though John Kerry promised to expand the war and become the Lyndon Johnson of Iraq, But it did. It pulled a lot of people out of the anti-war movement, and they committed their energies and their organizing to this electoral farce that just happened. Well, that's over, and that's a good thing in my view. And it might even be a good thing in the long run that it's still Bush, because their ineptitude is creating huge tensions between them and their allies, which is not altogether bad for the rest of the world. Gabriel Coco has written quite a bit about this, and I think he's pretty close to the mark on it. But now we need to resuscitate this anti-war movement, and it needs to be resuscitated with a strong pedagogic aspect, where the left wing of the anti-war movement, the anti-imperial pole of the anti-war movement, builds the anti-war movement in a way where we begin to sort of deconstruct the lies that are built there, and to begin to describe how this system actually works, because as this crisis in Iraq gets worse, more and more people are going to come to a teachable moment, and it's time for us to begin describing this system to them, in a way that stands people up. And the other thing is, we need to understand the difference between making a demand and making an aggressive request. You know, we can go out there and march on the mall in Washington, D.C. all we want, and go home, and then they do whatever they're going to do anyway, and nothing's going to change. And we just got to understand that elected officials have never changed a damn thing on their own. The only time they've gone up and made changes is whenever they had to, because they were under pressure from mass movements that were willing to disrupt the system.
Right.
You know, I call it 3D organizing. You know, we've got to go out there and do the teaching to delegitimize. Then we've got to be willing to disobey and take this thing to a new level. And if that doesn't work, we got to be willing to disrupt. You know, I'm a big advocate of global intifada. You know, now that doesn't mean I'm an adventurist and say we go out there with a small group of people and we haven't developed a mass movement right now. You see what I'm saying? And a few of us go to jail and everybody gets forgotten about, and they use it as an excuse to go out there and wipe out a movement. But I'm saying this movement has to incrementally escalate, because we've got to get to the point where we disrupt the system before we're going to get all these people in Washington, D.C. to change anything.
Stan, we're going to have to take a break here real quick, and I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking to Stan Goff, and you're listening to KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org. We'll be right back with Stan Goff, and I want to give out the number because we're going to go to phones. The number is 818-985-5735, 985-5735, area code 818. We'll be right back.
In the Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, a new film directed and co-written by Rush Moore and the Royal Tenenbaum's Wes Anderson, internationally famous oceanographer Steve Zissou, played by Bill Murray, and his crew, Team Zissou, set sail on an expedition to hunt down the mysterious, elusive, possibly non-existent, jaguar shark that killed Zissou's partner during an earlier outing. They are joined by a young airline pilot, played by Owen Wilson, who may or may not be Zisu's son, a beautiful journalist, Kate Blanchett, and Zisu's estranged wife and co-producer, Eleanor, played by Angelica Houston. They face overwhelming complications, including pirates, kidnapping, and bankruptcy. Life Aquatic, which also stars Willem Dafoe, Jeff Goldblum, and Bud Cort, will be screened for KPFK Film Club members at 7:30 p.m., Monday, December 6th, at Beverly Center. Reservations a must through the station switchboard, anytime during working hours.
Whenever we stand against the flow of opinion on strongly contested issues, a man does what he must, in spite of personal consequences, in spite of obstacles, and dangers, and pressures. And that is the basis of all human morality.
Now let's talk about self-expression, true expression. Open your minds without question, no doubt. Tell me what you're thinking about. Let's try to set aside pride and clout. Can you believe I feel the same exact way?
All right, we're back, and you're listening to Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and I'm joined on the phone by Stan Goff. Stan Goff was a soldier in the Army Special Operations and is an author of numerous books on issue of U.S. imperialism and a new book called Full Spectrum Disorder. Stan, before we go to phones, I want to ask you a question about the role of white supremacy and patriarchy in the U.S. system. You've talked a lot about it, and you say that it's an organizing principle of American society.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
You mean by that? I mean, I think this is, to me, again, this is one of these things that's fairly obvious. The reason it doesn't isn't obvious is because people aren't taught to ask any questions about it. If all you got to do is look at Congress, if you don't believe me. Look at Congress, and then look at a photo gallery of the Fortune 500 CEOs, and look who runs Wall Street. And you know, it's not magic. It's easy to see. Now you have a few tokens here and there. You've got, you know, even up until recently, you had, you know, Colin and Condoleezza. I forgot where I came from as colored decoys in the executive branch, but. That doesn't, and gender decoys, but that doesn't change the essential facts of American society. You just look at the data. The empirical data supports what I'm saying about that. White supremacy's always been an organizing principle of American society because American society was built on slavery and genocide and land expropriation. And so the ideological justification for those activities, which were not incidental, you know, they were actually the core processes in the formation of the American nation as it currently exists. And it hasn't gone away. It hasn't gone away. All you've got to do is just look at the stats. Look at the stats, the difference between African Americans and white people. 14-to-1 disparity in net worth on average. You know, that's not an issue of inequality. That's an issue of colonialism. You see what I'm saying? And people, you know, cognitive dissonance is one of these things where people can't sustain a contradiction like that, so they have to rationalize it away. And one of the ways that gets rationalized away is through the ideology of white supremacy.
Right.
60% of white people vote Republican. And ever since the Nixon administration, ever since the Nixon campaign, the first successful Nixon campaign, white supremacy has been the central political organizing principle of the Republican Party. You know, and there's plenty of evidence. Anybody that's curious, Google search Nixon's Southern Strategy and see what it was about, and see how much of it has changed. And see how Ronald Reagan talked about welfare queens. What does that mean? You know, the Willie Horton ads. All you got to do is just follow the development of the Republican Party since the Nixon administration, when they stole the mantle as the party of white supremacy from the Southern Democrats.
Stan, we're going to go to a caller now. We're going to jump in to do some calls, and first caller is going to be Camille from Beverly Hills.
Hi, Stan.
Hello.
I'm really enjoying hearing you talk with such knowledge base, especially with your background. And I hate to say that I have a kind of negative, apprehension about speaking to someone from special ops, but you seem very sweet. My knowledge base is from UFO background, conspiracy theory, government mind control projects, and things like that. And these are things that have personally involved me and people that I know. There's been a lot of talk about special ops being subjected to mind control, and I was wondering if you could go any further. I know you've said you've read some forbidden texts, but have you read things like Jim Mars's Inside Job and books by David Icke and other authors who really push the envelope as far as what 9/11 was really about and what kind of technology is being used against the public, as well as just control of the media?
I tend to think it's not, and I'm not someone who dismisses conspiracies out of hand, because the ruling class uses conspiracies to maintain its power, but I don't see conspiracies being, sort of motive force under society. I think the systemic forces are much more powerful in terms of being determinative. I don't know the authors that you're talking about. I myself have had some pretty serious questions about the whole 9/11 story, though I don't. And I can't, I don't want to divert the discussion into my reasons for thinking it wasn't something that was engineered by the United States government, but certainly I think there was a certain element of foreknowledge in it. Mind control and special operations, I wasn't subjected to anything that you could really call mind control aside from the sort of usual, sort of institutional indoctrination, but it wasn't anything that was any more notable than, say, the indoctrination that someone gets whenever they go to work for IBM. All institutions and all employers have, a certain sort of culture that they promote, and a certain sort of culture that is an outgrowth of the kind of activities that they're involved in. But in terms of using, technology and drugs and things like that to control people, that's not something I've ever seen. Special
okay, Camille, thanks for your phone call. We're going to move to Keith in Los Angeles.
Oh,
Keith, do you have a question?
Yeah, hi, Stan. I got a quick comment and a question. My first quick comment is I'm African-American, and I don't mean this to be racist. It's good to hear a white boy talking real truth. It's really refreshing.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it.
And my question is, I know this war costs billions of dollars to fight every day. I was just wondering, how long can we actually sustain this before America goes broke?
Well, this is kind of an interesting thing that I've been looking into for the past few months. It's like, how do we do that? How do you keep, going deeper and deeper in debt? And actually, it's pretty interesting how they do it. Who was the guy, the bank robber? And they said, why do you rob banks? He says, that's where the money is. I forget the guy's name, but at any rate, that's sort of this old truism that's out there. Well, the money is in the OECD countries, or the countries with big economies, Western Europe, Japan, and China. And you know what? They're paying for this entire war. They pay for it. What they do is the U.S. government takes out loans in the form of a bond issuance from the Treasury Department, Treasury bonds. They're loans that the United States gets from these other countries. The Western Europeans have billions of dollars. The Russians have billions of dollars, I think $50 billion in Russia. $600 billion in loans have been made by China to the United States in the form of treasury bonds that now make up the majority of the currency assets in their central bank reserves, which means their entire economy is backstopped by these bonds that they've taken, this debt they bought from, $800 billion from Japan. So, what a lot of people don't realize, it's one reason it's not quite accurate to say, if we stop the war now, we'd have a lot of this money available for other stuff. That's not necessarily true, because these other countries loan that money to the United States, even though all of them know at this point that they've loaned so much the United States never has any intention of paying it back. It's an economic game of chicken, because what they've done is they've got these dollar-denominated assets, these treasury bills, and their central banks, as their currency reserves. This is to backstop and protect their own currency from speculative attack. And if they call the question about what is this money really worth, which the United States produces simply by printing it. In any other country, you know, you'd go broke doing that because your money wouldn't, your money would be like the money in Germany in the 1930s, a wheelbarrow full of buy a loaf of bread. You see what I'm saying? They can't do that because they everybody's afraid to sell their dollars off too fast because it'll wipe out the value in their own central banks. It's a really interesting system, and it's really at the core of how U.S. imperialism works vis-a-vis its so-called allies and you know, fellow industrial nations around the world. Is they basically strong-arm these loans from them as a way to keep the U.S. economy afloat so that they don't overnight lose too much value of the dollar and wipe out the value in their own central. And I know that sounds sort of complex and arcane, but if people just sort of go on the web and look up something called dollar hegemony, it can be explained put that in quotes in a Google search and take your time with it, and it's not really that arcane. It's something that's pretty easy to understand, and it's absolutely at the center of how we managed to finance a war that's now reported to cost $5.6 billion a week. The reason is we just keep printing the money, and when we print too much, we don't let it create inflation in our own economy. We ship the inflation over to other countries, first as T-bills and their central bank reserves, and now with this sort of gradual devaluation of the dollar that the Alan Greenspan is overseeing right now. So what we do is we create monetary crisis here, and we ship it off to our so-called allies as a way of financing the war. It's pretty tricky stuff. I mean, it's really, we've got some pretty creditable con men working in Washington, D.C.
Keith, I want to thank you for your call to KPFK.
Okay.
I want to move on because there's a lot of callers on the line. But before I do, Stan, you have a quote on the front of your website. It says, "Perfect masculinity is sociopathic." What is the role of patriarchy?
The role of patriarchy is so thoroughgoing that it's like air, and we're immersed in it, but we take it for granted and don't even see it. It's in every single thing we do. And I would start by saying that people have to understand how sexuality itself is constructed, because sexuality is not something that arises from some natural drive. It's not something that sort of floats above history. It's something that's constructed in specific social and cultural ways. And sexuality in our culture is constructed as aggression. A masculinity is constructed as aggression. And this dovetails very nicely with the kind of, if you look at what you see in all your films and everything right now, they're all big apologies for warfare, and warfare is constructed, you know, sort of this raw, masculine, violent energy that goes out and sort of cleanses the world of all its problems. These are cultural myths that underwrite the very way that we think, the way that we feel about one another, the way that we relate to one another. Relations between men and women right now are not relations between two equal subjects, but they're constructed sexually as a relation between a male subject and a female object. And this colors the way that we see every single aspect of our lives.
Yeah.
Every single aspect. When I say that perfect masculinity is sociopathic, you have to see how that perfect masculinity is taken to its absurd conclusion in a situation like Vietnam or Iraq.
Stan,
people begin to do things like kill people for fun.
Yeah. Stan, I hate to interrupt you on this thought because it's a subject we need to talk about for an hour. I want to get to another caller before we have to get off the air. We have a few more minutes. Michael in Long Beach.
Hello?
Thanks for calling KPFK. Do you have a question for Stan
Goff? Yes, actually a question and a couple of comments. First of all, I'm sure that Mr. Goff is familiar with Lydell Hart, who wrote the book Strategy and Defense and Deterrence back in the 50s and 60s.
Way back then, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Hart, you can pontificate about his qualifications, but he made the observation that the old adage, he who prepares for who wants peace must prepare for war. His statement on that was, given the number of wars we've had since, following that advice, it was obviously wrong. And I would like to just thank you for your being on the program. My one question to you is, I'm firmly of the belief that we have what Hemingway called the fifth column, who are deliberately trying to destroy the economy from within in the United States, these people running things in Washington now, because they are, you know, their policy here is pure insanity. And I'm just wondering, I believe there's a method to that madness. I believe these people are deeply unpatriotic and committed to
Caller,
the destruction
of the
United
States. Have to wrap up real quick, so if you have
so
a question.
I just wanted to ask if you think that's an accurate assessment of the situation. Also, I'd really like to request that the station go back to the format where economically deprived people, unlike myself, who can't afford to stay on the air, go back to just picking up the phone and letting people ask questions that way, because a lot of people who are,
okay,
who don't have the money really need to be able to call in and get through to you.
Got it. Yeah. We're going to give some information about getting in contact with Stan later. Stan, do you have any final comments?
I don't know. I'm not really clear on what the fifth column was about, but I would just add to his quote from Little Hart that Einstein said, you cannot simultaneously prepare for war and prevent it. I think that's a pretty accurate observation.
Yeah. Stan, I want to thank you very much for being on the program today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, and do you have a website? I know there's bringthemhomenow.org.
That's the one I'd send people to.
Okay, bringthemhomenow.org. And there's also counterpunch.org, which has a number of Stan's articles. And thanks for listening to Indie Media on Air. I want to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, and Maggie LePeak behind the board. And stay tuned. And thanks. Next week, there'll be Bronwyn up for Indie Media on Air.
Open your minds without question, no doubt. Tell me what you're thinking about. Let's try to set aside pride and clout. Can you believe I feel the same exact way you do? You truly do believe these modern ways.
You've been listening to Indie Media on Air, heard Mondays from 3 to 4 in the afternoon on listener-supported KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world. The Voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report is coming up next. Stay tuned. If you try to fight back, they're locking your ass up. And Chuck already told you that I sell.